Do Democratic Party leaders in Florida take the African-American vote for granted? That discussion's just ahead. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app, listen to us there anytime, or on iTunes, or on our Facebook page, where we are streaming this show live right now. Just ahead, Tia Mitchell of the Florida Times-Union about a recent dust-up that has African-Americans wondering if they're being taken seriously in the Florida Democratic Party. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, with the U.S. Supreme Court lifting the hold on part of President Trump's travel ban, we've got a closer look at how that could affect the First Coast and local refugee resettlement programs. Plus, sustainable tips for this hurricane season. That's in today's Going Green. All of that ahead. But first this hour, it was a bit of a dust-up this month during the Florida Democratic Party's Leadership Blue fundraiser that featured a talk by former Vice President Joe Biden. Party Chairman Stephen Battelle scrapped the formality of introducing elected officials that were in attendance, and that angered several of those officials. But Battelle, who is white, singled out African Americans, telling Senator Lauren Brook, who's also white, that members of the Black caucus in the Florida Democratic Party were acting childish and like three-year-olds. That according to reports in Politico and the Miami Herald. Battelle quickly apologized, but again, it has some African Americans asking if their longtime loyalty to the Democratic Party has been worth it, and if they're being given the respect they deserve and a place at the table when important decisions are made. Florida Times-Union Tallahassee Bureau Chief Tia Mitchell recently wrote a column about the incident and the larger questions raised, and she's on the line now from Tallahassee with more. Tia, good morning.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. Do you think the African-American, or do you think the Democratic Party takes for granted the votes of African-Americans? Give us a call, 549-2937, that's 549-2937, or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to at Melissa in Jax, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page. Tia, let's begin by discussing what happened at this event. Lots of excitement among the state's Democrats to go hear a big talk by former Vice President Joe Biden, who may run for president in 2020, correct?
Yes, and so it was. I was not there, but from all accounts, it was a very nice event, great crowd. They raised a lot of money. Of course, most of the Democratic state representatives tend to go. And, you know, part of it is getting involved in party politics, but part of it is the chance to be recognized as, you know, among the top leaders in the Democratic Party in the state, you know. So I do think, you know, I don't want to downplay the significance of being recognized because, you know, the Democratic Party doesn't have a lot of elected officials at the state level where the Republican Party is in control and often has a supermajority. So they were wanting their chance to be recognized, but also their... When he changed the program, it wasn't just that they said, oh, we don't get to get on stage and get our shine. They were concerned that, you know, communication and they were, you know, you got told one thing and 5 seconds later, someone else is telling you something else. So they said there was confusion, miscommunication, lack of communication that kind of, you know, made some of them frustrated. And they made sure that the chairman knew that they weren't happy with how things had unfolded kind of behind the scenes. But at that point, it was behind the scenes.
Okay. And so Battelle apologized for his remarks. And can you tell us a little bit more about how that was received?
Yes. So, you know, according to the reports in Politico and Miami Herald, it was all just kind of behind the scenes, you know, frustration until Battelle made those comments to Lauren Brook, and she went to at least one or more of her colleagues and kind of said, hey, he said this to me. And Lauren Brook has not spoken publicly about the conversation, but Senator Oscar Brannon, who is a Senate Democratic leader, Lauren Book is his deputy, and he did speak out. He was concerned. He is African-American. And so the assumption, you know, is that Lauren Book told Oscar Brannon. Oscar Brannon got frustrated and went to the media. And, you know, he said that's a sign of disrespect. Again, not just the disrespect of, you know, not bringing the elected officials on stage, but for singling out African-American legislators when the frustration was pretty universal from the reports that we've read. You know, there was Janet Cruz, who's a Hispanic, and she was frustrated, and white Democratic state representatives who were also frustrated at how things were being handled. So it was the concern that Battelle and his, you know, they got frustrated and came to him, and then he got frustrated because they were frustrated almost, but that he took out that anger and focused only on African-American legislators. And so Oscar Brannon was upset. Keone McGee, who is a leader in the House, also African-American, they kind of became the spokesman. And Battelle did apologize immediately. He also sat down pretty quickly with the Democratic legislators, I believe maybe even that same night, to try to smooth things over. Of course, that didn't keep it from becoming an issue in the media, and in, you know, it was no longer behind the scenes at that point. He also met privately with Senator Brannon and Representative McGee, because at that point, if they had walked out of that meeting saying he needed to step down, he probably would have had to step down just for the optics. But they came away from that meeting saying they're going to move forward.
Okay. And of course, both Republicans and Democrats in the state are seeking unity going into the 2018 midterm elections and then looking ahead to 2020. What does this say, Tia Mitchell, about the larger issues within the state Democratic Party, as there does appear to be a rift? And we see it, a local rift here in Duval County at times, too.
Yes.
Between African-American Democrats and white Democrats who are trying to figure out how to turn the state blue, take the state back in their point of view after losing it to President Trump.
Yeah, I think it's not just racial divisions, although this highlights the impact when black people, being one of the most reliable voting blocs for Democrats, if you lose the confidence of your African-American elected officials and or your African-American voters, that really leaves Democrats in a bind. But what to me and what I said in my column is it's proof that Battelle has a lot to learn. He was the outsider candidate to become the chairman of the Florida Democratic Party. He was not necessarily your grassroots person who had been on the inside forever. He was a businessman who can raise a lot of money. And he basically came in and said, hey, we need to do something different. We need to embrace the more progressive arm. We need to get out there and raise money. But what I think he lacks is in the skill of the politics and managing the egos and managing the personalities, managing your different constituency groups within this big party. So that is where the Democratic Party and the Republican Party has the same challenges. But, of course, the Republican Party right now is in the driver's seat, so those challenges don't have as much fallout. But Democrats are going to have to remain unified if they have any chance of gaining seats in the 2018 election. And I do think, you know, Oscar Brannon knew that, and that's why he decided to bring this out into the forefront and bring it to the media. He, you know, to say, hey, if you're not going to respect us as black officials, we can move our money, the Senate Democrats' money, the House Democrats' money, outside of the party, which weakens you even more.
You know, we saw, I wanted to point out, the African-American Democrats on the Jacksonville City Council voted as a bloc recently to elect the new president, a white Republican, Anna Brochet, because they felt she was listening more to their concerns than the Democratic candidate. So,
right.
Going forward, you know, what are both parties' strategy to try to attract this key voting block?
And that's the point, you know, for, you know, me being an African-American, you know, African-Americans always say, yes, at times we do feel like the Democrats take us for granted. They just say, we know black folks are going to vote for the Democratic candidate, so we don't have to focus on them as much. You know, one example of that is the Hillary Clinton campaign. She did not campaign in Jacksonville, you know, and the perception that created was that Hillary Clinton didn't visit certain areas where she felt that she couldn't win additional votes. And so I think, fortunately for the Democratic Party, there is no clear alternative for that black voting bloc. I'm not, all black people don't vote Democrat. There are plenty of black Republicans, black independents. But by and large, black people do vote Democrat. But that's because they don't see an alternative. The Republican Party, especially in the age of Donald Trump, that's not going to attract a large swatch of black folks to all of a sudden start voting Republican. You know, Rick Scott's policies didn't attract a lot of African-American voters. So they continue to vote Democrat almost by default.
All right, let's go to your calls for Tia Mitchell, Tallahassee Bureau Chief of the Florida Times Union. What do you think about her recent column where the state's African-American Democrats say their party takes them for granted? 549-2937. Tom on the west side. Hey, Tom.
Yes, good morning. I totally agree that the Democrats have taken the blacks for granted for a long time, but I think she's also touching on the bigger problem, too, that the party is so hopelessly disorganized and badly led at this point that it culminated in the elections where there were no Democrats running, and it allowed the Republicans to lock the Democrats out of these important local elections. And that's very concerning. And then in addition to that, you know, it's beyond just blacks, because both parties are now ignoring the poor. So, yeah, there's a lot of failure to represent the people at this point. And that's what I have to say about this issue.
Thanks, Tom. Tia.
And I think that's, you know, both political parties and the Republican parties have tried to strategize what can we do to make our party more welcoming, more big tent. Neither the Republican Party hasn't figured out how to make their party bigger tent for minorities and the poor without alienating their base. That's the issue with the Republican Party. The Democratic Party is very big tent, but that creates fractures and fissures, and that it's hard sometimes to coalesce because you have so many competing interests. And, you know, people always say, well, we need a third party, but United States democracy, it's always been a two-party system. It hasn't always been the same two parties, but by and large, you know, U.S. government has run on a two-party system. I think, you know, in Florida, the key is locally to kind of, if the parties locally can get on one accord, then that'll help on a statewide basis. So the fact that the Duval County Democratic Party is not on one accord is more problematic, in my opinion, than the Florida Democratic Party having, you know, fissures. And so I think that, to me, if I was the state party, I would focus on each county Democratic Party and say, get your act together, and maybe we can have more success in 2018.
And I misspoke just a minute ago. The new city council president, Anna Broche, Twitter has just informed me she's actually Asian American. Thanks for that reminder. Here's a tweet for you, Tia, from Jim. Democrats will not win another national or Florida-wide election without the support of black voters ever again. Agree?
I mean, I definitely think the Democrats will have a hard time winning statewide and national elections if they lose the African-American voting bloc, because that, again, is among their most consistent bloc. But I don't think the African-American voting bloc is abandoning Democrats. Now, the concern, again, with what we saw in 2016 with the presidential race is, can you energize and activate the African-American voting bloc so that they vote as opposed to staying home? There are Black Democrats who stayed home in 2016 as opposed to coming out in droves in 2008 and 2012 because Barack Obama energized them in a way that made them vote. Now, if you get Black folks staying home and sitting out, the Republicans in Florida are going to have more success in 2018, and the Republicans nationwide will have more success in 2020.
All right, let's go to Eustra on the South Side. Hey, Eustra, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment on African-Americans being historically not necessarily neglected, but just kind of taken for granted. I do believe that that is the case. I've worked on a few campaigns, and even just noticing, you know, historically with campaigns and the way that they work is that there's a very, very huge drive to recruit minorities and get the representation in the election and get them to vote. But after the official gets elected, there's very little done for these groups of people, whether it be in their neighborhoods or on a local level or even just having their issues raised. And I think that one of the things that can be done is just action, you know, putting these people to work or doing things that, you know, affect these people's lives on a daily basis.
Tia Mitchell.
That is a valid point. And I do think it's difficult for Democrats because you in Florida particularly, they're not in the majority. They're not in the majority in the city council. They're not in the majority in the legislature. So they have to kind of take their small wins when they can. But I agree that sometimes, and Democratic elected officials will tell you this privately, that they even get frustrated because sometimes their caucus members, by and large, get satisfied with small potatoes, or they'll get satisfied with, you know, a few budget projects in their district and back off some of the larger, more controversial issues. That was a big debate with the Democratic Party. How hard should they fight for Medicaid expansion in the legislature when it was a hot topic in 2014 and 2015 and 2013? And they fought to an extent one session. The next session, they totally let it go. And at the time, the Democratic leader was Mark Pafford, and he's white. But he was very passionate about healthcare issues, and he said in retrospect, he sometimes wonders, should they have fought harder? Should they have used their little bit of power in procedural issues to try to push for Medicaid expansion? Because that's what their constituencies want. But it's hard because the argument on the other side is we're fighting for things the Republicans will never give us. And so we're spending our political capital on issues that we'll never be able to actualize. And that's a tough place to be politically. But that's the reality, you know, especially in Jacksonville, too.
Yeah, Ray in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Ray. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, I understand that, of course, the Democrats have indeed taken the Black bloc vote as a bloc and have taken it for granted, and that not enough attention is being paid to Black issues. But what's lost in this is the fact that, you know, the Black caucus did act a little childishly, and so the fact that the leader observed that shouldn't result in, you know, public crucifixion. There is no doubt that, you know, Blacks need to be ingrained and equal in all areas of the society, but constantly setting yourselves apart doesn't necessarily help that cause.
Thank you, Ray. Tia?
Hey, Ray, yeah. I just want to clarify to Ray and everyone who's listening, I think the argument by Battelle can be made that legislators were acting childish. If he had made that argument and taken race out of it, as I said in my column, I probably wouldn't have written on it. But he singled out Blacks, even though there were Hispanics, quote unquote, acting childish, and white legislators, quote unquote, acting childish. So the question becomes, why was he only concerned about the African-American voters when there were other legislators of other races who had the exact same concerns? had the exact same frustration and the exact same reaction. And that, again, brings a bigger issue beyond Democratic Party as to, you know, when there's an issue and race is made, then black people get accused of making it a racial issue or playing the race card. But it was not black people who injected race into what happened at Leadership Blue. That was Stephen Battelle.
Always fascinating to have you on the show. Thanks for your insights. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Tia Mitchell, the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Florida Times-Union, on with us. And much more still ahead. Later, a look at using environmentally sound products, even during a hurricane. Yeah, that's in our Going Green. But up next, the local connection to helping refugees heading here to the First Coast and to safe spots around the world. Back in a moment.
Consider political Washington and the dysfunctional state of affairs there. And now, consider the economy.
The uncertainty aspect is a major factor behind a lot of investment decisions.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The economic impact of instability, that is next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
How is Jacksonville spending our tax money? For years, city leaders have talked about bringing jobs and updating infrastructure to make the city more attractive. But are those investments spread across the city equally? Join our panel of experts and moderator Melissa Ross for a live, interactive, televised discussion. Community Thread, City Spending, Where Should Our Money Go? Thursday night at 8 on WJCT-TV and 89.9 WJCT-FM.
I decided to close the door on gambling, blackjack, poker. It didn't matter what form, that part of my life was now over. I fell in love and I moved to Seattle to be with this woman. And, you know, Seattle is a little bit different from New York, the city. It is a city where nobody is trying to accomplish anything.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour. True stories told live from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, local supporters of refugees are still trying to determine the impact of the recent Supreme Court ruling to partially lift the stay on President Trump's travel ban. Meanwhile, others in our area have been traveling the world to help thousands of refugees trying to escape from ISIS. One person who's spent the past several months doing just that is local corporate attorney David Ward. He joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, Jose Vega. He's director of World Relief Jacksonville.
Good morning.
Jose, great to see you. And in a moment, we'll get Jose on the record reacting to the Supreme Court ruling on the partial lifting of the stay on President Trump's travel ban. And here's our question to callers. What do you think of that Supreme Court decision? Give us a call at 549-2937. We'll talk about that in a minute, but first, David Ward, you're a corporate attorney here in Jacksonville, and you've been traveling for months trying to negotiate and coordinate safe passage for thousands of refugees fleeing the barbarity of ISIS. How did you come to be pulled into that dangerous work?
Quite the wild story. I maintained several contacts with some former military special forces folks who are involved in humanitarian work around the world. Got a call about this time last year, sitting in my office here in Jacksonville, and asked if I could be on a plane to Amman the next day. Uh-huh. And didn't really tell me for what. As somebody that I'm really close with and is a trusted friend of mine, so I asked a little bit more. And they had been contacted by several wealthy Americans asking outside of the normal channels of humanitarian resettlement, outside of the UNHCR, outside of Caritas and USAID, to work rescuing those folks who slip between the cracks and don't really have a means to not only do things like fill out paperwork, but really don't have, convenient to today's show, a sufficient connection with anywhere around the world. So finding resettlement options for those folks, in some cases running special missions to extract them from ISIS territory and finding places to resettle them around the world was our task.
And how successful were you all in that task?
We were modestly successful. We rescued just over 4,000 refugees in the span of about 7 months.
That's a lot of people.
Yes. So the majority of them from Iraq and Syria, fleeing the Islamic State, but some of them who have been stuck in limbo in places like Jordan and Beirut and Lebanon, resettling them around the world.
And some can languish for years waiting for a place to go.
Oh, absolutely. As you'll hear from some of our work here in Jacksonville, some of other folks work here in Jacksonville, folks can wait for almost decades in some of these places to just for the chance to move around the world to a safe new location.
A new life.
Yeah.
Jose Vega, you're director of World Relief Jacksonville. And as we continue to talk about this and some of David's experiences overseas, tell us a little bit about World Relief's work and in particular how this Supreme Court ruling that will allow a limited version of the president's proposed travel ban to take effect. How will that affect your work here in Jacksonville?
Great. World Relief here in Jacksonville, I work as a resettlement agency here in town. And our main work is to find housing, medical services, benefits, and of course, employment for our refugees that are coming. Those are our main goals as soon as a refugee comes. About the travel ban that is coming in place again. At the beginning, this travel ban was for 7 countries. Right now, it's just for 6, which are Iraq, Iran, Syria, Sudan, Somalia, Libya, and Yemen. So those are the 6 countries that they're not allowed to come here to the United States.
And unless they have what's called a bona fide U.S. connection, how will that be interpreted?
That will be interpreted in many ways, in these ways. If you have a family or a U.S. tie here in the country that can really sponsor you or bring you here, and you can prove that you can bring this family to you, that is one criteria that the government can say, yes, we can bring these families. The other thing also is on the legislation that they put over there in this caucus, they use the term entity. If there's any entity who can request this family, and those are the questions that we have here locally. The question is the refugee agency will be considered an entity? Oh, those questions also the Supreme Court doesn't have an answer yet.
So a lot of unanswered questions.
Yes.
Do you consider your status with some of these refugees maybe to be in limbo based on this ruling?
Based on this ruling, what's going on right now is a couple of people have already on the pipe to come here to the United States. And with this travel ban, they say, well, we're going to put that on hold. And again, those people were already vetted. They were already being they look around their life for a long time. They have been waiting for a refugee camp sometimes for many, many years. And right now they're in limbo. They were just
for at least 120 days.
At least 120 days.
So David Ward, you worked with refugees from 2 countries that are now under this narrowly upheld ban, Iraq and Syria. Your reaction?
Sure. I think in a lot of ways, and Jose will probably echo this as being even more intimately involved in the resettlement process than I am, in many ways, and to be frank, I'm a Republican. I consider myself relatively involved in politics. I've seen this ban from the beginning in both stages of its iteration, as it's now the second revised travel ban, as a problem looking for a solution. It's very hard to come to the United States. Anybody will tell you that. It is one of the hardest countries to immigrate to in the world, especially if you're from a place like Iraq, Syria, or let alone Somalia or Yemen. So while I don't I understand sort of the impetus, especially the political charge from where this travel ban comes from. I don't necessarily see how it's narrowly tailored to fit a true specific objective of the United States as far as immigration policy. While keeping our national security in line is obviously a priority, I think we would all agree on that.
We all agree on that.
It's already very, very hard to come to the United States, as evidenced by some of my work overseas. We didn't immigrate. You know, we didn't help one person resettle to the United States. We looked to other countries, countries like Australia, countries like Brazil, with a little bit more of an open door policy.
And in the process of working with these refugees, you've spoken about the fact that your views on these issues changed. How so?
Sure. I think, and I was just as guilty of it as a lot of folks that I know, a lot of my politics were informed by a, you know, sort of the privilege of being in America, looking at things at a strictly objective policy level and not really informing my political views with compassion. Both of my parents are educators. Mm-hmm. When you meet somebody, you know, a couple of parents with two young children who are the age of my parents, who are also teachers, the only difference being that they happen to live in Kurdistan in northern Iraq and who have left their home, don't have any money, they have the clothes on their back, and no way to work. That really starts to inform how you look at the world and how you look at different policies.
And I think you touch a really good word over there, that the word compassion. Because there's two words, I think, that are taking in place at this time, which is safety and compassion. And when you're talking about safety, we really approve what the government is trying to do in a way that, well, we need to be safe in this country. But how about the compassion element? We cannot eliminate that element for the families that are trying to flee or run from the danger that they are going through in their countries.
Absolutely.
Let's go to some calls on this. What are your thoughts about the Supreme Court's ruling the other day on President Trump's travel ban, 549-2937. Jeff is in Riverside. Hey, Jeff, good morning.
Hey, good morning, and happy Tuesday.
You too.
You kind of answered my question. I was going to ask David how seeing the Middle East refugee crisis up close and personal had changed his opinion on the travel ban, but I think he kind of just touched on that. So maybe if he wants to elaborate on how seeing that up close and personal has changed how he felt about it.
Okay, thanks for that.
Sure, I think, you know, sort of like I mentioned, when you meet people who were doctors, lawyers, and Jose certainly interacts with these folks from all over the world, who have now been stripped of what I would consider a place of identity and a feeling of identity. You know, we all have occupations in what we do, not only in our free time, but what we do, you know, personally every day for work. When you take that away from somebody, when you take away, especially over there, but around the world, a father's ability to provide for his family, that's something that, you know, beyond the rhetoric of our political discourse here, that supersedes just about any political belief you could have. You know, when you see those firsthand personal stories, that starts to change how you feel. And when I, you know, have come back to the United States and had conversations with folks that I do business with or just friends in casual conversations, that really sort of elevates the discourse when you start sharing personal stories. It makes it's a heck of a lot different than the detached opinions a lot of us have with no fault of our own.
Jose, what is the status then of the local refugee resettlement program for World Relief? Will it even continue given this ruling?
At this point, we're still going to be continuing.
You're going forward.
We're going forward. We were resettling for this year, I think, almost our numbers were 255 just for our office. And they increased that number to 305. So 100 refugees more are going to be coming for our office. It's not going to be, I think, a slowdown. Probably there's going to be a month that we're going to receive a full amount of people because until the travel ban again taking place. So, and then going back to the answer that about that caller that just make a question, I think we need to hear more stories from people that are coming from those countries. We need to let the people know about why they're coming here, why they're trying. They're not coming here for just travel or just vacation. They just wanted to come here to have a good time, they're fleeing their country because of fear. Yeah, so that's what those are the stories that we need to tell.
And to be clear, the High Court on Tuesday ruled that the Trump administration can block travelers from Syria, Sudan, Somalia, Libya, Iran, and Yemen mm-hmm. unless they can prove a bona fide relationship with a person or entity here in these United States. The Trump administration is expected to launch this limited travel ban on Thursday, tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow.
So we will be watching then tomorrow to see how this is being implemented at airports around the country.
We're going to take a really good look into that and to see, because they say in 72 hours it will be tomorrow on Thursday. And so we're looking to very closely to see what is the result of that.
Here's a tweet from Paula. The travel ban doesn't include Saudi Arabia. This is like using a basketball net to go fishing with. There's a big hole. Do you agree with that? Should Saudi Arabia have been part of this ban?
My answer to that will be, and I believe in the criteria of the government into taking a look with all the FBI, the CIA, and all the government entities to see those countries and just look onto them if they're a risk to this country. So my answer to that will be the government have the enough resources to decide which countries are.
And David Ward, it's interesting to note as well that despite a lot of rhetoric around this issue, most of the refugees that were on schedule to come into this country this year, about 50,000, almost all of them have actually been admitted. So
right.
For all this hue and cry, most of the people that had been going through the process still came into the country.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah?
There's more people displaced right now around the world than at any time since World War II. When you start to think about the gravity of the situation we're dealing with, I, like Jose, I'm sure, has a great amount of faith in our U.S. government and their ability to do their jobs thoroughly with the best interests and national security of American citizens in mind. So like we mentioned earlier, it's already very hard to get into the United States of America. The folks that are making it through these multiple rounds of vetting, background checks, and waiting are generally not the folks that you need to be worried about, regardless of what country they're from.
Now, immigration advocates, civil rights lawyers already going forward with legal challenges. Jose Vega, will World Relief be part of that effort in any way?
World Relief at this point, in different offices, we have 20 offices around the country. We are helping refugees that are in immigration issues also. So we have offices around the country doing that right now.
But will you be part of any legal action challenging, trying to litigate this again?
Our office and our home office in Baltimore is held very closely and looking very closely into this process. We really have been advocating for a long time since this came through. And we're still doing that in the government level. So we put together almost 3 months ago a letter to the different Christian leaders around the country that went to the government, and that also make a huge impact.
It's also being reported today that the Department of Homeland Security, whose officials help sort of vet the visa applicants and decide which foreigners can come into the country, they represent the union, the Customs and Border Protection agents. They are asking for more detailed guidance from the administration to help avoid a repeat of the chaos that we saw in January when there was chaos at the nation's airports. All right, let's go to Rick on the west side. Hi, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. Let me take you off speakerphone.
That'd be a good idea.
I wanted to agree with the previous caller and to some extent your Republican guest that Donald Trump's ban is not really an immigration bill. If it were an immigration bill designed to prevent terrorism, it would include at least some of those countries from which terrorists have actually come. Previous caller mentioned Saudi Arabia especially. I think what it really is an attempt by Donald Trump to create an enemy. Every tin horn dictator, tries to create a sense of emergency, danger, fear. and then point at someone that the people can hold responsible for their fear. And in this case, it's refugees without any evidence whatsoever that these people are of any real danger, and a good deal of evidence that they're an asset to the community. So I think the bill has nothing to do with immigration, has everything to do with creating a sense of fear and danger and emergency, you know, of which they intend to take full advantage. And that's it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for that, Rick. Someone else just called into the show, but he hung up before he changed his mind about going on the air. But he was going to say the opposite, actually, that he agrees with the travel ban. So this is, you know, it's a very divisive issue. David.
Sure. I think, you know, as far as what the last caller just said, I think there is some merit to the fact that America as a country, as a beacon, if we are truly going to be a beacon of a Republican, lowercase r society, and be one of strength and independence, viewing folks as other in general, at least in my personal opinion, is actually, you know, a contrarian view. It is the antithesis of what I think America should be. There's no strength in governing or legislating from fear, and without even commenting on the travel ban necessarily, as an overarching principle, that's what America is about. In fact, those same ideals is what causes folks around the world, whether they're from Central America or the Middle East, to immigrate to the United States. So it's time for Republicans, Democrats, Independents, everybody, citizens in general, to really have some self-reflection on what these bans or what our state legislatures do, and how they act and their rhetoric with regards to these issues in terms of, are we projecting a perception of strength around the world by viewing anybody as other, rather than the inclusive nature that's caused so many immigrants to come to this country over the years?
This country has been resettling refugees in this 70 years, for many, many years.
Since the end of World War II.
Yeah. So for many, many years. So, but if we are just working, trying to do something, reacting to in fear, I don't think we're going to get to the place where we're going to all feel well all together or with the agreement, because on the basis, because we are coming from fear, so I don't think we're going to get to a place where we're going to agree on that.
We'll continue to follow it. And by the way, this will be implemented beginning tomorrow, so look out for lots of coverage on that. In the meantime, Attorney David Ward, Jose Vega, Director of World Relief Jacksonville, gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we'll be right back.
On the next Radio Lab.
A young child ripped from the arms of the only parents she's ever known.
Turned over to the Native American biological father she has never met.
A custody battle over a little girl.
You're like, whoa, how can this possibly be okay?
That threatens the future of hundreds of Native nations.
His child being given up for adoption without his knowledge.
There goes Indian law.
There were literally communities where there were no children.
That's on the next Radio Lab.
Saturdays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part 2.
Hello, I'm Doug Hansard. And I listen to the Florida Times Union On Demand as read by WJCT Radio Reading Service volunteers. The sound quality is excellent. This is a great asset for people like me, sightless and on the go. The Florida Times Union daily on the radio reading website at wjct.org/radio reading. Take advantage of it, and while you're there, register as a listener.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, hurricane season is officially here. Are you prepared? WJCT is actually part of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Make sure to tune to us during any storm. Also, ServPro Jacksonville South and Arlington is one of three storm-certified response teams in the state of Florida. They've got a message today. You can even practice sustainability during the big storm. It's today's Going Green, and here with more about storm season, we welcome ServPro Operations Manager Chandler St. Peter. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Good. Thanks for being here. So you're the largest franchise in Northeast Florida. ServPro is getting ready for a busy few months with hurricane season coming upon us. What are some of the big things you're looking at?
Mainly just the weather, just seeing what's coming in our area, getting prepared, making sure we have the resources available nearby to capture everything we can and help everybody as quick as possible.
You have a disaster recovery team
Absolutely.
That you deploy in the event of a major storm. What are some of the things you work on if, say, we were to have a direct hit this year?
Yeah, absolutely. So we call if we were to have a direct hit to Jacksonville, we reach out to our corporate disaster recovery team, and they'll bring in resources, more equipment, more manpower, desk and dehumidifiers, air movers to help dry out as many homes as we can as quick as possible.
There was a lot of flooding during Matthew that you worked on.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. What were some of the biggest issues you saw out there?
A lot in St. Augustine. We've done a lot of work, and we're still doing work from Hurricane Matthew in St. Augustine area, Ponte Vedra area. A lot of businesses were out, a lot of schools, different commercial spaces as well as homes that are still put out.
And you have a hotline that's going to be manned 24/7
Absolutely.
In the event of a storm.
Yeah, 904-721-2230 is our hotline. It's 24/7. You can call any time of the day, any night. We have people readily available.
You also, it is our Going Green today, you provide green products for commercial and residential customers. What
Absolutely.
Are they?
Yeah, we have several different green products we get from our corporate office. One of the main ones that we use on a water damage is Benefact. It's a plant-based disinfectant that we spray after your house were to flood just to ensure that no microbial growth grows.
That can be a big concern, growth of microbes, mold. Those are homeowners' worst nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. If you don't attack it properly and get the house dry and take the the proper steps to remediate it quickly, it only takes about 72 hours for mold growth to occur. So you want to make sure you bring in a professional to make sure it's dry like us.
If you've got a house that's got several feet of floodwater in it, how does ServPro go in and mitigate that?
Yeah, so we wait. I mean, once the water level has gone down, we'll go in and extract the remaining water in the home, remove, basically it's typically, it's a 2-foot flood cut. If the water level's higher than that, we'll take it higher than that. We want to go 18 inches past the water line. We'll cut the drywall, remove the flooring, and just dry out the structure from there and then put it all back together for you.
And at what point do you assess, you know what?
It's too far.
It's too far gone. Like, is there a cutoff point?
There's really not for us to say. A lot of times that's a call that FEMA or the insurance carrier would make.
Okay.
Otherwise, if it's a claim or not a claim and the homeowner's taking it on, yeah, we can absolutely give you the call, but it would take a pretty significant flood. I mean, it would have to go over 8 feet for us to really tell you it's past the point of saving.
Now, you've got a big event coming up. It's not till October, right at the tail end of hurricane season. But what's going to be happening? Fred Funk is involved in this, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. It's our seventh annual customer appreciation golf tournament. We do it every year in October. It's Friday, October 20th at the Blue Sky Golf Course. The Funk and Zutello Foundation will be sponsoring it with us. And all the funds go to the foundation.
And just go to serveproject.jacksonvillesouth.com. Keep them in mind as hurricane season is with us. Knock on Formica. We won't have any serious flooding this season as we saw during Matthew last year. But thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
We really appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for having us.
He's Chandler St. Peter, Chief Operations Manager with ServPro. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime. Next on 1A, why a new study is making waves after finding that Seattle's minimum wage hike actually hurts its workers. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.